Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Mario Ritter Jr. and Brian Lynn. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Mario Ritter Jr.
Three men who made rechargeable lithium-ion batteries possible have won the 2019 Nobel Prize for Chemistry. One of the scientists is 97-year-old John Goodenough, who became the oldest winner of a Nobel Prize. Goodenough is a professor at the University of Texas at Austin. He will share the award with Stanley Whittingham, a professor at the State University of New York at Binghamton, and Akira Yoshino of Japan. Yoshino is a professor with Meijo University and a fellow with the Asahi Kasei Corporation. Sora Snogerup-Linse is a member of the Nobel Committee for Chemistry. She said the three men developed lightweight batteries, useful in many applications, truly portable electronics, mobile phones, pacemakers, but also long-distance electric cars. The invention of the lithium-ion battery has had a deep influence on modern life. It has made listening to music, watching television, and communicating on electric devices something that can be done almost anywhere. Whittingham started his research into lithium batteries in the 1970s at a time when world oil prices were high and energy availability a big concern. He developed a battery that combined lithium and titanium disulfide. It could produce 2 volts of power, but it was too explosive to be useful. But the British-American researcher established that lithium ions could be held by a special material to create a lightweight battery. Goodenough found that combining lithium with cobalt oxide could produce a more powerful battery, one that produced 4 volts. His research was an important step in the development of more powerful and safer batteries. Using Goodenough's design as a starting point, Yoshino developed the first commercially available lithium-ion battery in 1985. Yoshino's design used a carbon-based material to hold lithium ions. That made the battery lightweight and able to be recharged many times. The Nobel Committee said that lithium-ion batteries have laid the foundation of a wireless, fossil fuel-free society and are of the greatest benefit to humankind. I'm Mario Ritter Jr.
Wind energy is a fast-growing power source in the United States. Wind turbines, the huge devices that turn wind power into electricity, are being built across the country. Now, several big companies are planning to invest $70 billion for the first large-scale wind farms in waters just off America's coasts. Polly McMahon's family has been living on Block Island, a small island off the coast of Rhode Island, for 13 generations. One of the first offshore wind farms replaced the island's diesel-fueled power plant in 2016. "We have been blessed to have it," McMahon told the Associated Press. However, the administration of President Donald Trump has not been as supportive of wind power. Trump has made hundreds of comments on the website Twitter and in public opposing the expansion of wind power. "They say the noise causes cancer," Trump told a crowd of supporters last spring. The AP reported that the American Cancer Society immediately rejected that claim.
Now, wind industry officials and activists are worried that the federal government may be pulling back from years of support for wind energy. In August, the U.S. Interior Department announced it was withholding approval for the country's first large-scale offshore wind project. The $2.8 billion project included 84 very large turbines. The plan was to start building 24 kilometers from Martha's Vineyard, an island off the coast of Massachusetts. Vineyard Wind hoped to start operating by 2022. The company has partners from the Netherlands and Spain. It already has agreements to supply electric utilities to Massachusetts. Investors supporting several other big offshore wind projects of their own want to follow Vineyard Wind. The energy company Shell is among the businesses seeking agreements to pay for the use of federal land. Some are offering more than $100 million for offshore wind farm sites. The Interior Department listed the growth in business interest for offshore wind projects as one reason it wanted more study before moving forward. It directed Vineyard Wind to research the overall effect of the East Coast's wind industry growth. Interior Department spokesman Nicholas Goodwin said in a statement that offshore energy remains an important part of the Trump administration's energy plan. But that plan includes ensuring activities are safe and environmentally responsible. Public opinion of wind power has changed since America's first major proposed offshore wind project, Cape Wind, off the coast of Cape Cod, Massachusetts. Influential people living in the area pushed to halt the plan 16 years ago. They said the turbines would kill birds and ruin the appearance of the natural seacoast. But new technological developments in recent years permit wind turbines to be placed further offshore. They also produce energy more efficiently. I'm Dorothy Gundy.
And I'm Pete Musto. We'll be right back.
Many Americans use smartphones for most or all of their day-to-day communication activities. One result is that people have gotten faster and better at typing emails and text messages on their phones. But how fast are we at using an electronic device compared to typing words on a traditional physical keyboard? A new study has some answers. A team of researchers carried out an experiment. It involved more than 37,000 volunteers from over 160 countries. The study was a project of researchers from Finland's Aalto University, England's University of Cambridge, and ETH Zurich, the Swiss Federal Institute of Technology. They used an internet-based system to test the typing speed of people on their smartphones. On average, the volunteers estimated they spent about 6 hours a day using their phones. The majority said they used two thumbs to write messages. Both Android and iPhone users were tested, and most said they used the device's standard keyboard. The volunteers were given 15 English sentences to type out on their phones as quickly and accurately as possible. The research team found that on average, people wrote about 36 words per minute. Those tested made a typing mistake 2.3% of the time. The researchers noted that 36 words per minute is about 25% slower than the average rate for people using a computer keyboard. In a 2018 University of Cambridge study, the average speed for computer typists was about 52 words per minute. The researchers noted one reason for the narrowing of speed rates between smartphones and computers. They said people have become slower at typing on keyboards over the years. 75% of those taking part in the study had typing speeds below 44 words per minute. But the fastest phone typists reached speeds of over 80 words per minute. The published results show there was no difference between males and females in the typing speeds. Subjects who reported using two thumbs or two fingers reached speeds of 38 words per minute. Those who said they used only one finger typed 29 words per minute. Among age groups, the fastest typists on an electronic device were between 10 and 19 years old. They typed nearly 40 words per minute. People aged 40 to 49 wrote about 29 words per minute, and the rate dropped to 26 words per minute for those aged 50 to 59. Anna Feit, a researcher at ETH Zurich, helped lead the study. She said it makes sense that younger people have higher typing speeds because they generally spend a lot more time on their devices. Such a large amount of experience transfers to the development of typing skill, Feit said, and explains why young people who spend more time with social media communicating with each other are picking up higher speeds. The researchers also found that a phone's automatic correct tool can be extremely helpful. Users were able to type faster than those without the correct tool. But word prediction tools were not very helpful to users in the experiment, noted Aalto University researcher Sun-Joon Kim. The given understanding is that techniques like word completion help people, Kim said. But what we found out is that the time spent thinking about the word suggestions often outweighs the time it would take you to type the letters, making you slower overall. The researchers call the difference between typing words on a smartphone and a physical keyboard the typing gap. They predict this gap will further narrow in the future as people get less skilled with keyboards and as smart methods for typing on devices continue to improve. I'm Brian Lynn.
From VOA Learning English, welcome to The Making of a Nation. I'm Steve Ember. Today we tell the story of how a British attack on Fort McHenry in the port of Baltimore led to the Star-Spangled Banner, America's national anthem. In the summer of 1814, British forces attacked Washington, D.C. They burned the Capitol building, the White House, and other public buildings. Then they withdrew to their ships in the Chesapeake Bay. British General Robert Ross and Admiral George Cockburn led the attack on Washington. Next, they planned to attack Baltimore. But the people of Baltimore expected the attack and began to prepare for it. 50,000 of them built defenses around the city. The port of Baltimore was protected by Fort McHenry. The guns and cannon of the fort could prevent British ships from reaching the city. The British began with a land attack against Baltimore. General Ross, Admiral Cockburn, and about 4,000 British soldiers landed at North Point, a finger of land reaching into the Chesapeake Bay. From North Point, it was a march of about 22 kilometers to Baltimore. The British began marching at about 7 in the morning. General Ross and Admiral Cockburn stopped their men after an hour. The two commanders and several of their officers rode to a nearby farmhouse and forced the family living there to give them breakfast. When the British officers finished eating, the farmer asked General Ross where the British were going. "To Baltimore," he answered. The farmer told Ross that he might have some difficulty getting there because of the city's defenses. But the British general replied, "I will eat supper in Baltimore or in hell." When they returned to the march, Ross and Cockburn moved far in front of the British forces. A group of several hundred Americans opened fire on the British officers. Ross was hit. He died soon afterward. The Americans retreated, but they slowed the progress of the British soldiers. It was late the next day before the British force arrived to face the Army of Americans near Baltimore. The Americans were on high ground and had about 100 cannon to fire down on the British. The British commander ordered his men to rest for the night. He sent a message to the British warships to attack the city with guns and mortars. Such an attack, he felt, might cause the Americans to fall back. But the British ships had already been firing at Fort McHenry since early morning. The British guns were more powerful than those of the fort. the strength of their guns let the ships fire from so far away that the American guns could not hit them. Shells and bombs from British mortars fell like rain over Fort McHenry, but few Americans in the fort were hurt or killed. Most of the rockets and shells exploded in the air or missed. Many of them failed to explode. At the center of the fort flew a large American flag. The flag could be seen by the soldiers defending the city and by the British warships. The flag was also seen by a young American named Francis Scott Key. Key was a lawyer who had once thought of a life of religious work. He was also a poet and writer. He opposed war, but he loved his country and joined the army in Washington to help defend it. When the British withdrew from Washington, they took an American doctor named William Beans with them. Francis Scott Key knew the doctor and asked President Madison to request the British commander to release him. President Madison wrote the request, and Key agreed to carry it to Admiral Cockburn. Key also carried letters from wounded British soldiers in American hospitals. In one of the letters, a British soldier told of the excellent medical care he was being given. Cockburn agreed to free the doctor after he read the reports that his wounded men were receiving good medical care. But Cockburn would not permit the doctor or Key or a man who came with him to return to land until after the attack. So Francis Scott Key watched from a British warship as the shells and rockets fell on Fort McHenry. Years later, he said, "I saw the flag of my country waving over a city, the strength and pride of my native state, a city devoted to plunder and desolation by its assailants. I witnessed the preparation for its assaults. I saw the array of its enemies as they advanced to the attack. I heard the sound of battle. The noise of the conflict fell upon my listening ear and told me that the brave and the free had met the invaders." All through the rainy day, the attack continued. Dr. Beans, watching with Key, had difficulty seeing the flag. He kept asking if the stars and stripes still flew above the fort. Until dark, Key could still see it. After that, he could only hope. Britain tried to land another force of men near the fort, but the Americans heard the boats and fired at them. The landing failed. Shells and rockets continued to rain down on Fort McHenry. At times, the fort's cannon answered. That told Key that the Americans had not surrendered. The British troops east of Baltimore spent most of the night trying to keep dry. Commanders could not decide if they should attack or retreat. Finally, orders came from the admiral: withdraw to your ships. A land attack against Baltimore's defenses would not be attempted. At first light of morning, British shells were still bursting in the air over the fort. The flag had holes in it from the British shells, but it still flew. The British shelling stopped at 7 o'clock. Key took an old letter from his pocket, and on it he wrote a poem about what he had seen. Oh, say, can you see by the dawn's early light what so proudly we hailed at the twilight's last gleaming, whose broad stripes and bright stars through the perilous fight, or the ramparts we watched, were so gallantly streaming, and the rocket's red glare, the bombs bursting in air, gave proof through the night that our flag was still there. Oh, say, does that star-spangled banner yet wave? Or the land of the free and the home of the brave? Americans sang these words and remembered the attack on Fort McHenry. Then, in 1931, Congress made the Star-Spangled Banner the national anthem of the United States. The unsuccessful British attack on Baltimore was followed by news that Britain had also suffered a defeat to the North. British General George Prevost had led 11,000 soldiers south from Montreal to New York. At Plattsburgh, on the western shore of Lake Champlain, his army was opposed by fewer than 4,000 Americans. General Prevost believed he needed to get control of the lake before moving against the American defenders. He requested the support of 4 British ships and about 10 gunboats. A similar-sized group of American ships also entered the lake. In a fierce battle, the American naval force sank the British ships. The Army decided not to attack without naval support. The 11,000 British soldiers turned around and marched back to Montreal. By the time of these battles, the United States and Britain had already agreed to discuss peace. The peace talks began in the summer at Ghent in Belgium. At first, the British were in no hurry to sign a peace treaty. They believed their forces would be able to capture parts of the United States. Britain demanded as a condition for peace that the United States give large areas of its northwest to the Indians. It also said America must give Canada other areas along the border. And Britain would not promise to stop seizing American sailors and putting them in the British Navy. But British policy at the peace talks changed after the battles of Baltimore and Plattsburgh.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.